She makes me sound so grand. I'm not. I'm going to steal a line from Professor Sachs. I don't know if you've watched any of his videos on the web or on YouTube, but he got up to speak and he said that he was a great follower of you two and that he knew that the first act was always the warm-up, and so he knew that his would be short and sweet. Well, I feel like the maid has been to come and sweep the stage after the Bono's just been on. So I don't think you're going to get quite the caliber or the erudite lecture that he gave, but I hope you'll enjoy the remarks that I have to say. I know your project was on Red, and I wondered, oddly enough, if Bono had named Red after the economic situation, because when Professor Sachs speaks, he uses a map where he puts the poor countries in red and the best, richest countries in yellow. Don't know.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I would have loved to have asked him, but, you know. Anyway, I didn't get to hear my two lovely girls. They've moved now. There's one. Stories, and I hope I can come back and hear your research because I feel a bit out there. After reading all the materials on the internet and hearing about the millions that Red has earned for charity, I'm not really sure where my own presentation will take us, but we can discuss this later with questions and answers. We'll see where we go. As to my contribution to your discussion and why the monies given to these countries need to be carefully distributed and monitored, I'd like to give you what I hope will be some insight and wisdom into how we are viewed from some of the other cultures in the world that I have experienced in my work and travels. I know that many of you are probably well-traveled too, visitors perhaps, green card holders, naturalized American citizens, or as well as I was born in the USA, to use a Bruce Springsteen expression. I was born in the States, but I hold dual citizenship, and my travels have been varied and broad. However, how I traveled in these particular countries was not always in the most hospitable conditions. I'm a climber, I'm an explorer, and I've done a bit of charity work. My first marriage was to someone who became a golf pro. And when I was a young bride on the golf tour, my husband and I started to travel America. We were gone 42 weeks out of the year. We stayed in different low-rent motels and homes of the people who sponsored the golf tournaments, as there were no Holiday Inns, Ramadas, or Howard Johnsons. You guys wouldn't know that. Those were not built into the middle or late 60s. I had certainly traveled with my parents across America. We did not really meet the people in each state as we were just ordinary tourists. When I first went on the golf tour, you really got to know the people in each town and state and often saw them year after year. However, the first year was a sharp learning curve. You may ask, why? Golf was, and still is, a very expensive game, and the courses where the PGA held their tournaments were the best. We were immigrants in this strange and wealthy world. I remember being at the Firestones home where we'd been housed in Pebble Beach for the Bing Crosby. I was so innocent. I mean, I was 20, 21. I'd just graduated from university. And filled with wonder that it never entered my head that they might think me strange or my cultural habits of Texas quite odd. At one point during drinks before dinner, I made a comment, "You know, we're really different," I said, with a patronizing tone designed to make me feel very small. One of the VIP guests said, "My dear, you could not have said it better." I've started my talk today with this story because it served me well when in later life I moved to Europe as a real immigrant, having never been there with two little boys, and went on into my life of adventure all over the world. My first memory of what it is like to live under a regime or a threatened society was with my first husband on the golf tour in Bogota, Colombia, in 1969. We were taken everywhere by plated cars and always with a driver and a shotgun rider. As the men played golf and we walked the course, you could hear the machine guns in the distance from the guerrillas fighting. The poverty was extreme and the riches immense. Life moved on, and I was in Burma, now Myanmar, where everything seemed so pristine and calm until the guide kept speaking of relocation. What she meant was the villages were being moved that had been there for centuries and then placed where the government wanted them. I accidentally strayed from the group as a young boy wanted to show me his home. We went behind a temple, saw his home, and on the way back, bumped into machine gun guards who were enforcing the curfew on the locals until we left, in case they told us something unsavory about the government. They glared at us, but let us go. I just attended a conference on China at Esalen, and they are doing exactly the same relocations for the Three Gorge Dam project. And as you're very aware, in the current situation, Myanmar is having great difficulty getting in their goods to help the people. I think one of the ships actually sank, and the regime is being very obstreperous. On a trip to Bombay, now Mumbai, our taxi was almost overturned by the university students rioting. It had nothing to do with us. We were just caught in the mob. However, it demonstrated to me that we as foreigners were an easier target for anger. The anger can be projected away from the students' fears and needs and onto another culture, which at that moment in time was us in the taxi. When I was studying in London at the Anna Freud Clinic for my psychotherapy degree, we lived in international students' house for 5 years. Our neighbors above us were Chinese and Nigerian, below, Sudanese. We were in a safe, secure, and culturally rich environment. I think it would be difficult to find any place like it in the world, or anywhere else at least. Because of this rich environment, I was able to hire in the afternoons a young Indian Sikh. I'd wanted a male to spend time with the boys as they had no father. He was amazing, and he helped them to put up an electric train. He had a lovely girlfriend who was studying medicine. They came together in the evenings if I needed a babysitter to look after my 2 young sons. One afternoon, there was a knock on the door, and a very elegant Indian man in a suit and tie arrived. He introduced himself as Nadir's father and explained that he was the ambassador to Switzerland for India. He was so sorry to bother me, but he needed to speak with Nadir urgently. I explained that he would be home in 15 minutes as he and the boys were in the park playing. He had a cup of tea and waited. Nadir arrived, greeted his father. They left to meet downstairs. Nadir returned and said that he would be leaving with his father, and he was so terribly sorry, but he could no longer continue working for me with the boys. That evening, his girlfriend arrived, frantic, as Nadir checked out of school and disappeared. Nadir later wrote to me to explain that he had unfortunately fallen in love with an untouchable, and that was not allowed in his family, as he was to do an arranged marriage. It helped me to begin to understand some of the difficulties of dealing with other cultures, whether it's trying to distribute medicine or raising children. One time, when we were coming back from an adventure in the Changtang in the mountains of China, we were crossing into Tibet. We arrived after a grueling hairpin drive in a bus with no shock absorbers, and a driver buzzed on betel nut so he did not fall asleep. We unpacked all our camping gear, and it was searched by one set of guards. Then we hired porters to cross the rope bridge, as it was very high, but we only had to walk across. But the porters did the dangerous bit by carrying tons of camping equipment on their backs. We arrived at another checking station, which was all Chinese, with no interpreters. We were searched and scrutinized. We were put under machine gun arrest, briefly, because one of the young Tibetans had tried to smuggle a boombox inside his backpack for the family. He was taken away, and we never saw him again. I was lucky enough to spend 10 days with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, when we were making a documentary for the BBC. We lived in the Dalai Lama's mother's house and worked with him every day. This is a man who has nothing but good humor and intelligence. Yet, the third morning, he apologized for his tiredness, as one of the young monks had been smuggled across the border after being tortured by the Chinese, and he had stayed with him through the night until he died. Now, with the Buddhist monks and all their troubles, both in Myanmar and Tibet, my Buddhist tendencies have become more entrenched, and I believe the only way we can really help is by in healing in whatever way we personally can achieve. The Chinese Olympics are coming later this summer, and there is controversy everywhere about boycotts and what does a country do or what does one do as an individual. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to travel with Mass General for Harvard. We're going to China in June. We've been given a 3-year contract to work with the hospitals in different fields there. I will tour the hospitals with my colleagues and hopefully start a program of psychotherapy by helping to train their doctors. We're doing this both with them visiting our university and by online supervision. I'm not selling iPods, T-shirts, or red computers, and nor will I have a red American Express card, but I will be doing all I can to change the planet in my very small way. However, there are other organizations and charities that are making a bigger difference. Yet there are a few organizations that I know of personally that just give money and let the distributors or recipients just get on with it. The first organization that did something for me and which changed my life was my very own Social Security system. And oddly enough, Professor Sachs was mentioning social systems and things. My mother died when I was 16 and she was 62. Her pension had just begun. The government actually allowed some of the funds to be partially released to help me with my university education. I didn't get a great deal, but the difference to me at that stage in my life and in my position helped me to stay in university and receive the first degree that took me forward on my life path, and potentially is why I stand before here before you today. Now I'm 63, and that same government has become not such a good Samaritan, wants me to wait to take my pension at 70 for the same rate I would receive at 65. If I take the pension now, I will be penalized. What happened? How did we end up in this predicament? I don't know, but I feel frustrated and upset that for my whole life while living in England, I paid my Social Security here, believing that all would be well and the world would be as it had been set out to be. When I read the article on Red, and I read some others, this somehow seemed to resonate in some ways, because I certainly think Bono and his mates have the right and good concept in mind. Most organizations that give do believe in what they're doing. However, having worked with a few, I know from firsthand experience that the monies or materials often do not make it to the final destination for which they are intended. In the New York Times on March the 29th, there was an article about theft from charities. I don't know if you saw it. It was alarming, but I did not believe all of it, as they used a very small statistical sampling. yet there were some interesting facts. The news report was based on data from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. They said all organizations, whether government for profit or nonprofit, lose on average 6% of their revenue to fraud every year. Applying that percentage to nonprofits, the total 2006 revenue being $665 billion, donations, government payments included, plus other income, they came up with a $40 billion estimate of loss. If the $40 billion figure is accurate, then the money lost to fraud equals the combined giving by all corporations and foundations in 2006. A report published by the Nonprofit and Voluntary Sector Quarterly in December of 2007 states that there were 58 cases reported to the fraud examiners. The range of loss was $200 million to $17 million, with the median fraud being $100,000. Now, it may be hard to compare this with the last one, as they didn't give any statistics. One of the people who had just spoken to a group of nonprofit executives said, every single one of them had a fraud story to tell. It's been going on for years, but there's a feeling that it shouldn't be discussed. Okay, maybe this is true. But at the same time, I think I know, and from firsthand knowledge, that there is a small way to prevent this from happening. I would like to give you an example of a program that was changed by an honest organization. This is a short film I made of a clinic in Ethiopia for children with HIV, where I work part-time. I have just been to visit Ethiopia. It's a beautiful country, but a land with many problems, and we need to help them. I went with four doctors. They sponsor a clinic there for HIV. As we drove through the streets of Addis Ababa, I noticed how different it is from the way people are in the West. Everyone walks. The fruit, vegetable, and meat are open air. The major transportation are donkeys or small mules. They carry all the goods which have to do with household or farming or food. You see a van occasionally with lots of people and then baggage and goods on top. The first day, we went to visit the school. Mrs. Ababich sponsors the school along with two doctors, Dr. Albert Scheller and Dr. Feliga. They have about 140 children. This includes the HIV children, the orphans, and some town children. The orphans and town children were there to greet us, and we were presented with flowers in a small program. We then moved to a room with HIV parents. Actually, there were very few. Most of them are dead. The children are being raised by their grandmothers or their aunties. The school is beautiful, especially for a country like this. They use many handmade charts. The language is Aramis with a Latin base. Therefore, most Ethiopians can speak other languages, as they know the one thing we as Westerners do not, that is Latin. They make many of their materials from papier-mâché and matchboxes for numbers and the alphabet. This is one of the orphans. He graduated 20 years ago. He's a big success. He has his large vehicle driving license, and he drove us while we were there. The HIV children gave us flowers. They were dressed in white and looked very, very pretty. The school also has street girls. These girls are prostitutes. They are between the age of about 11 to 14. They are being taught a trade of catering and also about birth control. They prepare meals for the children at the school, and they make a grain bread from teff, which is called Angelina, and the local bread. They provide all the hotels in the area of Addis Ababa, including the one we stayed in. The local women come in to help and teach them.
The baking process is quite primitive, but the bread is delicious. They also make spices for the local grocery markets. We then went to lunch, but first we had to see what the children were having. The HIV children eat separately, but only because of the special diet, not because they are HIV. Lunch was delicious and made from vegetables raised in their garden. We had coffee ceremony. Coffee was invented in Ethiopia. On the way to the next school, we made a home visit. This home has HIV children. The grandmother is raising them as their parents are dead. They are very house proud. They have a vegetable garden, a rose garden, and have papered the walls with tin labels. The kitchen is an open fire. This seemed to be true for everyone, even including rather wealthy people. The orphanage was most impressive, extremely clean, and the flower gardens are tended by the children. They are building a new clinic, but at the moment they're in the old one. The babies you see were found in dustbins or on the street. We were not allowed to see one of the babies as they were not sure what was wrong with him. The new clinic will have outpatient facilities, beds, and a surgical ward. The next day, we went to visit the hospital. It was a communist hospital. As you can see, it still has the red star, but now it's run by the government. Dr. Ahmed, a very well-known specialist, greeted us. He's the head of the clinic and does a great job. On the third day, we went to visit the vocation school. The drive was beautiful. You see the shepherds and the countryside. This is the only profession, other than being a farmer, that was available before our school began changing this and making the children have a trade and go to school. It's quite dusty, but worth going to see. We stopped for a light lunch and the services. They're very primitive compared to our Western world. There are two schools. One is for girls. They learn weaving and how to dye the yarns and make them into clothes. It is teaching them beauty and also a skill. The boys are learning building and carpentry. Village on our way to the next stop, and the children had just got out of school. This is an example of a local hut. There are other kinds, but normally this is what the people live in. The countryside is particularly beautiful. Here's a two-story. We went to a country school in the south. It was very beautiful and remote. They are quite wealthy for this area, but still primitive. Their pride and joy is the new school. That's me inside. The huts are cleaner, the children well fed and groomed. Our last stop was Lalibela. We went to see the churches built inside mountains. It is a very high elevation and in the north of Ethiopia. This was our hotel. Well, it wasn't terribly luxurious. I'm afraid the famine people took over my mind and the visit was not as enjoyable as I had hoped because of this. The people walk 6 hours to get to the village and then sit all day in the hot sun. We took a walk through the village. That's a luxurious two-story house. They only got electricity 6 years ago. Yet the people have an elegance and grace. At dusk, the pilgrims receive their 50-kilogram sack of grain from the EU. Then it is loaded onto whatever is available, the children, donkeys, even their old people. They walk for 6 hours home through the dark night. I want to help little girls like this one. I hope you will want to help also. Thank you.
Unfortunately, the little girl you saw in the photo is now dead. She died about 6 weeks after I left. She was particularly captivating, and I don't know. I didn't get it. You can't get attached to all of them, but anyway, she's no longer with us. What do you think our biggest problem is? It's not the buildings in which the children live. It's not the food. Or the clothing. We have wonderful volunteers and teachers willing to give their time for free or very little money. Countries around the world send all these provisions. I'm sure you noticed all the sheets were the same. We get bulk shippings. Our biggest problem is bringing in and providing medicine. When I first started going, we hid the medicine in our cases and checked them through his luggage. Because if we shipped the medicine, the guards or airport representatives would confiscate them and sell them back on the black market. Because I happened to have the great pleasure of being a part-time resident in Santa Barbara, and I do a great deal of fundraising for direct relief, I realized that we had a solution. Our medications are now shipped directly to the clinics and schools, and they are safe. But the reason I knew about this program was because I lived here in Santa Barbara. Certainly the German and Ethiopian doctors I worked with did not know anything about this organization. And I think in today's paper, direct relief sending drugs and medicines today, I think it was in the news. Direct relief does not advertise or have any big companies that give them money. It's a hands-on organization. If it started to get bigger, If it started to get bigger, maybe we would have the same problems as other charities. I'm not really sure. I met Borders Without Doctors, the French doctor who was here last year, I think, and had dinner with him for 2 hours. And I'm sorry, I wish I'd taped or taken notes during that conversation because they also are wonderful at keeping their cost. And he was talking about how some of the bigger charities spend too much on other things. Now we know to some extent that the information we get is not quite the truth, or it's distorted or exaggerated. How do you see this affecting your future careers? You know you're not seeing the whole package. Do you quit giving to charities? Or do you just become more discretionary in where you place the funding you choose to give? You can make a difference by being discriminating. Remember, cultures such as the Middle East or Japan have a huge investment in honor and a deep vulnerability to shame. My friend Chang Chai, I hope I said that right, he's a really good friend of mine, who is one of the main leaders in human rights, lives here in the United States. He can never return to his country. And Long Lee, one of my other friends, served 2.5 years in labor camp for Tiananmen Square, and she can never return to her country. I was just with 23 Chinese journalists, very young, your age, who are here on work study program at Berkeley, and it was fascinating. They explained to me at length why the students were so upset in San Francisco when the Olympic torch demonstrations occurred. They feel the Tibetans are bringing shame to China, and that they, the people, these journalists and students, are losing face with other countries. It's humiliating to them as representatives of their country to be here in America. Others, such as the Netherlands or Scandinavia, are less shame-based and more honor-driven. When I toured Africa with the Norwegian consulate in 1989, they were conducting birth control clinics all over the country. They felt it was their duty to help the women in Africa to have more self-esteem and choice about themselves. I also have grandchildren growing up in Norway and Holland, for that matter. So from first-hand experience, I find that there are some countries which are more honor-based. Where does this honor-driven culture come from? What's the cause? Where does it go, especially here? What is the future of honor versus shame? Then there are the countries and cultures that need so much and sometimes have huge populations, such as India. I have a friend, Marilyn Tam, I think she's spoken to you, who has an organization called US Foundation. Every penny goes exactly where the charity says it will. At the moment, she's working to prevent blindness and promote mental and physical health for 100,000 children by distributing vitamin A and antiparasitic medicine in Burma and China. They hope to have reached all of the children in these two countries by 2010. There's also, I found on the web, and oddly enough, if it went straight to Jeffrey Sachs, who I didn't know was coming, Life Straw. I don't know if you have seen this. It's a Millennium Goal project, and it's fascinating. I'll pass it around for you if you want to see it. But, you know, you need to decide the organization that you would consider appropriate. Do your research. Give it your due diligence. Find out what the real story is before you go forward to helping financially or by giving your name to a charity. Hopefully, the discussion can lead to some goals and you can begin to formulate some ideas about procedure, which will lead to even more positive results for you and all of us. I'd like to thank you for listening. I'd like to get the ball rolling by asking you, have any of you had the experience of being a stranger in a completely different culture, and what was your experience? Thank you.
I'm a political asylee from
What's
India.
Your name?
Akanksha.
Akanksha, hi.
And I moved here in 2003, and I have not been allowed to go back since. And I guess in the process, 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. when my parents applied for me to be brought over here. And we're still waiting for our green cards. It's been over 7 years and have not been allowed to leave and go back. So
that's, I don't know. I mean, I was talking to Shao about this. I know I live in England and did for 32 years, and if someone told me that I could never come home, he and I had long night dinner conversations over a bottle of wine. It's a terrible feeling and experience. There's an incredibly powerful movie called A Man Without a Country, and I'm probably so old, I don't know if anybody else remembers it, but it's a black and white, and I think it was the Civil War, wasn't it? But if you have a chance, I know you have a movie society here. It deals with some of the issues of how one can speak out against one's country and then deal with not being able to go home. But you just got caught in a very bad situation. Hopefully, that can be eliminated. But I don't know. Thank you for telling me, though.
I kind of wanted to ask you about, there was an article in the New York Times today about Saudi Arabian women.
Read
it. Right. And it kind of, you know, I'm reading this, and it's, you know, intended to illuminate and educate a different culture, and especially a very potent aspect that is very visible. You know, we see these, mm-hmm. You know, the dress that the women wear, and I feel very ignorant on the subject. At the same time, you know, I'm reading this hoping to educate myself, but I kind of felt like the article did almost a disservice in that manner, where it tried to, you know, follow the lives of a couple of girls. But do you think articles like that are
interesting question, because there's been two. They had one on the males yesterday and then on the females today. And I have some Muslim friends, but I have not dealt with the Saudi Arabia society. But oddly enough, one of my Lebanese friends has and was friends with one of the princesses. And there's several, but I have a lot of Indian friends too. There's a couple of things I'd like to put forth and let you play with it. One, a lot of these marriages that are arranged do work. I mean, our way of having to be desperately in love sometimes makes us not think terribly well about what we're choosing. So I would put that forth. Also, they're very family-oriented, so you're not just marrying the man, you're marrying a family. At the same time, to be a woman in that culture and not be allowed to learn and to read and think, I would find very difficult. But my Lebanese friend who went many, many times on trips and traveled with the princess, because they had not known any better, the women were actually quite happy because their friendships, their loves, their emotional development was really centered on woman to woman. The men were the certainly gave them their children, but they didn't see them very often. I'm as ignorant as you, but that's what little I know about it. I know when Nadir was taken away, it was very difficult for me. Nadir was very, very distressed, and so was the young girl. And they never saw each other again. He never came back to England. He wasn't allowed back. And she finished her medical degree and never saw him again. So that gives you there's love and then there's family, and I don't have an answer to that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Jemima Goldsmith, do you know who she is? She married cricket player, the famous cricket player, and she tried to live in India. I'm Pakistan, I'm so sorry. She tried to live in Pakistan with his family and bore him two children and lived there, I think, 6 or 7 years. She just couldn't do it. She was just too Western. And she came back to England. And she and I talked about that. And he was running for political office, so, the regime on her was very strict. I don't know if that answers your question. But I did read the article. Yeah.
Hi. I studied abroad in France, which is, of course, a very Western, you know, country.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it really difficult to be an American in France a lot of times, just because...
They're French.
Right, but they're also, they're very well informed. And at the time, I wasn't, like, politically. Like, mm-hmm. they knew more about American politics than I did. And this was several years ago, and I found it really interesting that, like, that difference between, like, the European culture and the American culture, where they take pride in being very informed about political issues and stuff like that. And when I went back to France, I was, last summer, you know, I'm a global studies major now, so I know more about politics, and I was having a political discussion with a French guy, and then he actually ended up almost getting in a fist fight with another American guy that had no idea what he was talking about. So that was my experience in another country, and I felt somewhat accused in a certain way or looked down upon for being an American, but I feel like the second time I went back, it wasn't quite so much. But.
I'm a child of the 40s, and of course, isolationism is something that we constantly deal with, because you can live in America and never leave, and you can go to all sorts of cultures and places and do things. And I think I don't, and also our news is very biased. I hope that you will all take the time in this age of computers and television to watch, you know, other channels or to read other newspapers and get a more liberal, a sort of balanced view. I find it very difficult sometimes because I live half and half, and I can get very cross. But then Europe skews the news also. That's a two-way street. I don't know how we educate our young children more about the world. I heard someone briefly talking about slavery and making classes study things. I think they should. I remember, I'll tell you a story. I don't know if I said this in the speech I gave. When I was a little girl in first grade, we had cigar boxes. I don't know if you remember those, but that, and we all had to bring one to school, and we made a suitcase. And the travel bug bit me very early. I made a green aluminum foil. I thought it was just beautiful. And my father made me a leather strap. And I made decals of all the countries that I wanted to go visit. And I was five. But so I obviously was fascinated by travel even back then. But that, I have to say, from the town where I came from of 3,000 people in Texas, no one else seemed to be. The rest of them have not done that. Educate your own children. That's what I'd say.
Everyone here is familiar with my story because I've told it a million times, but I also lived in England, and my parents live in Poland right now, and also they lived in South Africa for a bit of time. And I think that the hardest thing for me living in these places, you know, I thought England would be so similar and we speak the same language and it's so easy. And a lot of the time that I was there, you know, I only thought that it was homesickness that was really the hardest part. But in retrospect, I got so much criticism from people everywhere that you meet at the pub and everything for being blonde and American. And there was so much put against me right away. And, you know, just dumb and flirty and this and that. And, you know, I thought that was the hardest part to overcome. And my mom always jokes about it and says, you wouldn't get half as much attention if you weren't blonde anywhere we live, because everyone just stares at you and they just think you're really interesting. And, you know, that's such a hard part. I'm sure in Paris that was a problem and everything.
Yeah, but you also don't know the shortcuts.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I can come home and I know the shortcuts here. And I've lived in England for years and I still don't know all the shortcuts. But I think I worked for the American Embassy as a psychotherapist and saw the military and the, you know, the different people coming through. There's two ways to be an American in a foreign country. And I feel very strongly about this. And you may totally disagree with me. You can build a sort of plastic bubble over yourself and stay American, and you can play baseball, and you can go to American restaurants, and you can have American friends, and you can join the American Women's Club, and you could never leave America and live anywhere in the world. And if you want to do that, that's fine. But you won't get the embarrassment. You won't be told, well, one, you do get up one's nose, don't you? I mean, but you'll learn. You'll learn a lot. And I think when you're my age, you'll look back and I think you'll be very pleased that you exposed yourself, because that's what you're talking about, is exposing yourself. And if you expose yourself, you get hurt. Just like no one ever tells you love is painful. Mm-hmm. It is. So, you know, I think it is important that you put yourself out there. And, you know, I just spent 10 days with all Chinese, and they think they get stared at, you know, so, and because they look funny. Or they, you know, they think that we think they look funny. So, you know, putting oneself in an uncomfortable position, making oneself learn and change, don't ever give that up. That's why I'm here. Do you think I'd be standing here today if it weren't for my friend? I don't do this.
I'll say something, because I've done a fair amount of traveling.
Thought you might have.
Over the years. And I think one of the things that I would recommend to people who are going to travel to a given country, and we do much too little of this, is read about the history of the country you're going to before you go there. Because I found, as an American, I would be sitting down, the first operation that I was responsible for buying in Europe actually was the Netherlands. And I was amazed how grateful the people were when you start talking and you would bring up their history and start talking about their country, because they said, well, we wouldn't expect an American to have done that. And you're not going to learn that from watching television, by the way. You know, H.L. Mencken once said that you can never lose money underestimating the taste of the American public, and our television today has kind of proved that. And, you know, if you want to go over to a foreign country and tell them the interesting saga of Anna Nicole Smith, all you do is reinforce their concept of really how shallow Americans are. And I say read about those countries because it is an entree, a conversational entree into getting a real rapport and a real dialogue going with the people who live in those countries.
And they'll open up.
A very famous country and western singer who died recently, I met him after he'd come home from Japan. This was 40 years ago. I said, what did you think? He said, dumbest people I ever met. And I said, what? He said, they don't speak English. You know, and that was not an atypical reaction from Americans who began to travel subsequent to the Second World War. Mm. So just a bit of advice. Wherever you're going, read up on the country you're going to, and you'll find you will be invited into a dialogue that you wouldn't have been invited to otherwise.
That's right, and you don't have to read history books. I mean, you can read their novels, their fiction, their poetry. You know, he's so right. You sit down at a dinner table, and they'll be pleased.
Hi.
I wish you guys would say your names.
My name's Matthew.
Hi, Matthew.
And I have a bit of an adventurous spirit, too. So when I was 18, I traveled with my girlfriend mostly through Italy, but a little bit of Greece and France, and just backpacked with big backpacks for 3 months. And I read up a little bit on basic customs and thank yous and your welcomes and stuff like that. And I felt like when I came back, I felt so different and was looking at my neighborhoods and country in a whole different light. I found a sense of community over in Italy that I didn't even feel over here. There was a language barrier, and that was hard, but I felt like people were friendly. I kind of found like the warmth in people, just backpacking through and meeting people and talking to them. a lot of people were surprised that Americans, they kept saying, like, I heard that a lot, like, an American, why are you traveling? Shouldn't you be in a 5-star hotel? And I'm like, I don't have a lot of money. And just like we kind of, you know, found the human in each other. And so I came back here and started getting into, like, global issues and stuff. And I don't know, I just felt like very more mature after I came back.
You know, that's a very good point. It does make you more mature.
Yeah.
It does. But that goes back to your point. It's because you were prepared to expose yourself and to perhaps, you know, have the language barrier and struggle a bit.
Yeah, and I found that asking questions helps, you know, and just...
Curiosity.
Ask, yeah, curiosity, exactly, yeah. And that's honest, and people recognize that for the
most
part.
Yeah. Well, I stutter, so I did okay today, but that also is a problem, you know, because if you do have any other language barrier like that, then it really can, you know, you sometimes won't speak when perhaps you should.
Hi, my name's Brianna.
Hi, Brianna.
And I have a question, and I hope that you can answer it. I studied abroad in China, lived there for a couple months, and needless to say, was stared at every single second of every day, and everything I experienced was completely different than I had ever experienced before. Every interaction, food, everything that I heard, saw. And during my study abroad, I did extensive studies in the Chinese Revolution and kind of unfortunately learned a lot of the negative aspects of China, which I think that you experienced in Tibet and seeing those things. And it's been 2 years now since I've been there, and I think I'm having a hard time trying to figure out if I could ever go back there and seeing what's happening with the Olympics. And I just want to know how you're dealing with seeing what you've seen and then knowing about what's happening with the Olympics and then, you know, continuing to go back there. Because I want to. I love the people and I love the culture, but the government and everything that I learned.
But you learn something every day. And I was, I must say, very pro-Tibetan. But I learned a lot from these young journalists. First of all, they're a different generation. I mean, most of them don't even... Tiananmen Square didn't even happen to them. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to them. And secondly, their anger, if you read, and I did not know this, the Tibetans do receive a subsidy for being a lesser race. Now, what you're going to do, the minute I say this, you're going to say, American Indians, that's what we did to them. Look what we did. We put them on reservations. I'm part Indian, so I can fight you on that one. But... at the same time, these young people don't get those benefits. They have to struggle, and their parents, their education's not free. You know, they live in very constricted, tiny, you know, places. And these kids have some of the best jobs. The government owns their newspapers, so everything they write is vetted by the government. One of the young girls I dealt with had just escaped a 2-year prison sentence because she had written an article about a German doctor who was putting artificial hearts into children in a Chinese hospital, and out of the 9, 8 of them had died. And the only reason that she actually did not go to jail was because I can't remember his name, but one of the very big politicians got caught in graft, and then the government wanted to make him the sacrificial lamb and let her go. So they are dealing with their own dilemmas about this. I mean, and Chow, he went to his first conference with the Tibetans because the Chinese would not give him, Akasha, a green card to go to, where was he going? I think he was going to South Africa. And so that's why he was banned from China, even though he was an active human rights person for China. And he's very pro-Tibetan. At the same time, he would say that he understands the Chinese position because they feel that they're losing face. They feel hurt. These kids are here. They didn't hurt the Tibetans. They have Tibetan friends, you know. So I all I can say is I'm, I, I've never been to China except in the mountains, and well, I've been there, but I always say I've never been to China because I've never been to Shanghai or Beijing, or, and that's where I'm going, and I'm going to be working in these hospitals. And can I change somebody's thought about us, about Tibet? I don't know, maybe. You know, I'm just one person. If you, as I said, if you teach your children things, if you teach one person something, you never know who they might be one day. They might be Barack Obama, you know.
Time for one more question. Hi. Actually, my younger sister is in... My name is Abby.
Hi, Abby.
Hi. My younger sister is in South Africa right now studying reconciliation with a small school that she's going to. But I thought about... And then she's going to be going to North Ireland, mm-hmm. Northern Ireland. And I was just wondering if... she's going to be talking with people about social reconciliation and things like that. Like on a, and since you're the psychology end of all of this is mm-hmm. very personal to people, and just wondering, maybe your take on learning from different in, like extreme situations,
yeah, like the Northern Irish,
exactly, and things like that that can we can, and especially because you spent so much time in England, I assume there's enough talk about that there. But what can we learn maybe from other, not so much past times, but things that are further into reconciliation emotionally between groups that we can apply to more current upheaval, I guess you could say.
Gosh, okay.
It can be as broad or yeah. as specific or a story. It doesn't matter. I just thought I'd bring it up.
I think the history, and he said it, I mean, if you want to know about Ireland, you've got to read about the history, because you know, it's not the IRA. I mean, it's not just the IRA. It's the whole historical the problem, as they call it. If you want to learn about Tibet, I mean, I went back and I've now got two books to read. You know, I was very pro-Tibetan. Well, now I need to learn a lot more about Tibet. And one of the boys has just written a book. He's Chinese. He's one of the leading Chinese journalists for the China Times. And he lost his job in China because the Wall Street Journal published a story about him, which his editor brought him in and said, gosh, that was just amazing. We're so proud of you. And then they said, but we're firing you because the government's unhappy. And he has written this book about the Tibetans, the real Tibetans, not what we hear about Tibet. And also, I mean, I know the Tibetan freedom fighters. I've met some of them. They're not angels, believe you me. That, you know, that doesn't mean that I think that the Dalai Lama tries the best he can. He doesn't want independence. He just wants, you know, them to listen. China has grown so fast, and it is so overwhelmed with all of its problems. And we better be very nice because we owe them a lot of money. And so, you know, we better try to work very hard with them. Anyway, I'm not a politician, but I hope that, does that help?
Alistair, thank you so much for joining us.